Okay, Randall, it's that time. Question you were not prepared for. Joel Embiid has won the 2023 Most Valuable Player in a controversial result over Nikola Jokic. People have been arguing about this. Randall, my question for you, are centers back?
Yes. Yeah. When the MVP was between basically two centers, I think that means they're back.
I could argue that Giannis could be the third best center in the league if he decided he wanted to be a center.
Oh, without a doubt, you're absolutely right.
Today, though, for episode 5, we're actually going back into the annals of time,
Yes.
and we're looking at one of the most, let's call them, underappreciated centers
Yeah.
of all time. That's fair.
I think that's fair, yeah.
So let's get into it. Episode 5, season 1. It's Randall's hometown hero, George Mikan. That question about the centers thing because we were doing prep before, I was doing prep before this, and I just typed in like, so let me pull the Google result up because it's actually kind of funny. So I pulled up this Google result that was essentially, when did centers become less important? That was my question that I put into Google. When did they become less important?
That's not a leading question at all.
Well, I was purposely for the reason for this. And what I found is there is a variety of articles about this, but they're all kind of in between the same period, 2012, 2013, 2017, 2018. You don't see this article anymore. And the only reason I bring it
Yeah.
up is it did feel like there was a time in the NBA when we had become like a post-center league.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you had the advent of, the Splash Brothers, right? Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, just and they're just, and then you had Giannis, you had Durant, you had Kyrie, you have LeBron. I mean, all these guys who were doing things not down in the low post, right? They're doing it out away from the basket. And they were successful. Very successful.
Well, and I think that's the other thing, it's not a hot take, it's a freezing cold take, but the impact that Steph Curry had, I always compare this to Tiger Woods. When Tiger Woods first showed up, Tiger Woods essentially made golf interesting and cool to people who did not care about golf, like myself. All of a sudden, there was this guy who was like, hey, this guy. And then, if you look at the post-Tiger sort of run after he won everything, what you have is tons of young golfers who came up watching Tiger, and now they all play like him. And that's why I wonder if he never won as many titles toward the end, because everyone sort of plays like him now. And I wonder if we're like a couple years away from that happening with the NBA anyway. All these guys who were in middle school and high school who were watching Curry, who just spent their entire basketball careers just shooting threes.
I think we're starting to see that as Curry gets older. I mean, he's in his what, mid-30s at least, right? So you're getting some younger guys, and pretty much, I mean, if you can't shoot a three, then you're useless on most teams. You have to at least be somewhat dangerous. I mean, look at Jokic and Embiid as good examples of centers who shoot the three. I mean, could you imagine Ewing and Olajuwon doing that?
No, and it's funny because there is a former center who used to play for the Utah Jazz, and I'm gonna be annoyed that I can't remember his name. I'm like looking him up right now. He was a foreign dude, and I want to say it was like a Mehmet Okur. Is that a name? Is that a guy?
That's a guy.
I want to say he was a guy on this Utah team who was a big who shot threes, but in the era when nobody wanted that. Like people were not interested in this guy for doing that. And now it's like, man, you would love this guy. It's like Trevor Ariza, like a guy who was out of time for his sport. Hey, look at that. Mentioning the name of the podcast. But I think like I look at Trevor Ariza with the Lakers in those 2000s. I'm like, this dude was maybe 5 to 10 years ahead of where he would really have made his best money.
Probably right. No, I think you're right. There are guys who could shoot back then that there it wasn't valued at all for as a big man. And but it's But now we see guys like Giannis, who isn't a three-point shooter, attempting threes, right?
Yeah.
You see LeBron, who's not a natural three-point shooter, just chucking them up there. I mean, he hits some, but you know, that's not where he excels. But you have to be dangerous from three, right? You have to at least be able, there has to be an option in your game.
Even watching that Lakers Golden State game, the first half I watched last night before I fell asleep because I'm 100 years old. you know, like when LeBron or Draymond has that open three, they're going to take it. And I, as a viewer, I'm like, oh, they're making that. That's an easy basket. I'm like almost surprised now when I see someone take an open three and miss it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. You're like, wow, that's a bad, wide open. I mean, even AD, he's shooting threes. So yeah, I think with the advent of big men being able to spread the floor and shoot a three, I think that means centers are back.
So let's look at one last thing before we jump into episode five, Randall. I was very excited because much like we've sort of learned as we've been doing this podcast for a couple episodes now, every time one of us prepares an episode, the other one always goes, man, I really learned something about this. I really learned a lot about this. And I got to tell you, the George Mikan thing, George Mikan is one of those names in basketball that when I read a list of like the top 10 centers of all time, before we did this episode, I would just kind of like skip him. I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever. George Mikan, cool. Where's Shaq? Do you know what I mean? Like,
Right.
And now, like, I'm looking at this list that I found from hoopshype.com where they ranked the 20 greatest centers ever. And they have Mikan listed at number 9. And now I'm looking at the guys who are ahead of him, and I'm like, wait, you got Patrick Ewing ahead of him? Patrick Ewing's not that good. Like, I'm a Knicks fan, and they don't win any titles. Like, if you want to make an argument for David Robinson or Hakeem Olajuwon or Shaq or one of these modern guys, that's fine. But as a guy who loves Patrick Ewing, I would take the guy who had tons of titles, I think, ahead of the guy who lost in the 90s.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in fairness to Patrick Ewing, the competition was much different for him.
Way different. Yeah,
but you're right. I mean, in terms of impact in the league and on his team, Mikan definitely surpassed Ewing. Mm. But Ewing had a longer career. I mean, we'll get into it in the episode. But you know, I thought that this was, you're right, it's a hometown hero because George Mikan was born in Joliet, Illinois, where I happen to reside, and I was actually born in. So, but beyond that, you know, I thought the timing of this was interesting because, you know, LeBron just took over the all-time scoring title from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, right? So one Laker passed it to another current Laker, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, George Mikan is kind of the first great Laker. So, granted, he never played in LA, but he was a Laker before they moved in Minneapolis. So I just thought it was kind of an interesting time to talk about this. And yeah, I learned a lot about George Mikan because even though he's a hometown hero, he's not celebrated here in any way, shape or form, which is kind of a shame.
So just before we get in, you're 1,000% right, by the way. I totally agree. Totally underreported, underappreciated, because as modern NBA fans, we really care about modern stuff. That's what at least the narrative I get. I just wanted to do this because we haven't done it in a couple episodes and I forgot about it. So I did a little bit of research before we get into today's episode. George Mikan's very first game playing for the Minneapolis Lakers was on April 11th, 1948. There's minimal stats for this game, but he scored 19 points on 11 for 13 field goal percentage. Ooh, that's phenomenal. Yeah, 11 for 13.
That is.
And I couldn't get the final score, but it was a 12-point win over the Baltimore Bullets, the Minneapolis Lakers. Huge win over the Baltimore Bullets. It's been a while since I've done this, so I wanted to bring it back. If you were watching that game on April 11th, 1948 and came home, you could listen to the number one song in America, Manana. It's Good Enough for Me by Peggy Lee, the number one song in America in 1948, on April 11th.
The faucet, she is dripping, and the fence, she's fallen down. My pocket needs some money so I can go in the town. My brother isn't working and my sister doesn't care. The car, she needs a motor so I can go anywhere.
You could also watch the number one film in America, the 1948 film The Search, which tells the story of a young Auschwitz survivor and his mother who search for each other in post-World War II Europe, starring Montgomery Clift.
The Search, the dramatic story of a runaway youngster in search of a future, an adventurous young American in search of simple justice, and a wandering mother in search of her son.
I bet that was pretty good.
I'm sure it was good. I've never heard of this before. And then you could go home and read, because people read a lot back then.
Yeah.
You could go home and read the number one book in America, Ides of March by Thornton Wilder, which sounds like a name from 1948. This is my son, Thornton Wilder. So there you are. Just a little pop culture history before we get in. Why don't we jump in, Randall? I don't want to wait too much longer.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of fun. All right. Episode 5, season 1. Let's learn about the legend, the man, the myth, George Mikan. Well, Randall, I'm excited that you decided to talk about this, because just looking at the introduction here, I learned something I didn't know already, and I'm going to let you make that announcement. But I just got to ask you, we've done Mr. Wrestling, Tim Woods.
Yeah.
We're about to do Mr. Basketball, George Mikan. Does this mean we eventually have to cover the Tom Selleck film, Mr. Baseball?
No, I haven't exactly been raking the ball lately.
The word is, he could be traded north.
It's not Canada.
Or west.
No, say it's not Cleveland.
But the smart money says he's headed east.
We got a call from a manager in
far east.
There's no way I'm gonna play in Japan.
Welcome to Japan, Mr. Baseball.
What do you think of our country?
The airport's nice.
I think we should at some point. I think it's only right. You're right.
At some point. Randall, I'm so happy to see you. And I'm very excited for this story. So I'm going to let you jump in, because I'm sure you got a lot to say about this one.
Yeah, this is a big one. So everybody just buckle up. Today's story is George Mikan, who is the first superstar in the NBA.
For sure.
And the reason why I wanted to do this story is George Mikan is actually a hometown hero. He is from Joliet, Illinois. Born in Joliet in 1924, nearly 50 years before me.
My first basketball hero was a guy named George Mikan, who was the first really superstar in NBA basketball. And I went to see him play. And after the game, he came out of the locker room and walked over to me and talked to me for 20 minutes. And at the time, I was third string varsity. He would just talk to a young basketball player. I was 6'7" then. He ended the conversation by saying, you got to come and play for the Lakers.
Now, I just have to ask, because when we did the Tim Woods episode and I told people he was from Utica, people were stunned. Like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. Is Mikan known from being Joliet? Is there like a whole thing in Joliet about Mikan, or is that still sort of surprising for people?
I don't know that it's there's a statue.
Sure.
So there's a statue in Joliet of George Mikan. His family's been in Joliet for forever. I think there's probably still, you know, family members. They were in local politics at one point. So I don't know that it would be a huge shock, but I'm sure there'd be people who'd be like, oh, yeah, or really, I didn't know that. So I don't think we celebrate him enough, considering what he was when you hear this story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I just wanted to point out some of my sources for this, because there's actually a lot of different sources you can go here.
Yeah.
Wikipedia, of course. There was an article in The Athletic by Rob Peterson that was really good about George Mikan at the NBA 75. And of course, YouTube, there's actually clips you can get of George Mikan playing basketball, which is pretty wild.
I've been starting to hunt him down for the editing process. Yeah,
exactly. And one thing I did want to point out that I found through Wikipedia, which is, if you go to their references pages, sometimes you can find a treasure trove.
Tons.
And there was a really cool story. The American Croatian Historical Review has a great write-up about George Mikan because George Mikan was Croatian. So
I saw he's in the Croatian Hall of Fame.
Yeah, absolutely. So amazing. We'll jump right in.
Yeah.
Because it's a big story. So yeah, for those of you who may know, George Mikan was the first NBA superstar.
He carried the NBA in the early years. You know, I think with the Minneapolis Lakers, they won 5 NBA championships. And of course, George was the man behind that. You remembered playing against him that he had a shot where he'd get the ball and pivot, drive, take a move to his left and shoot a shot off the backboard. But the thing about it was he led with his left elbow. And if your face was anywhere close to that, playing it, you got an elbow in the mouth and you spit out teeth for a few minutes.
He was a marquee player before there were marquee players. And they had to change the rules because of this guy. He was so dominant in his sport. And we're talking about basketball in the 1940s. So the game looked a little bit different than it does today. So his influence, to understand it, you need to understand exactly how different the game was in 1941. That's when George Mikan was a freshman at DePaul. Now, basketball had been around for 50 years, but the game was still evolving, right? And it evolved even up until today. So, for example, the rule mandating a jump ball at half court was after every made basket had only been eliminated 3 years before, so in the late 30s. So they used to jump it up every time somebody made a basket, okay? Jump shots were new and unusual and were considered showing off at this point in basketball history.
I just got to say, just not to cut you off, do you think that people were mad about the rule changes the way that people are currently mad about, like, the baseball rule? Were people just angry, you think? I'm sure they were, right? It's not the same game anymore.
Exactly. I'm sure there were some hardcore fans at this point, but it certainly didn't have the popularity it does today.
Sure,
but
of course.
Yeah, absolutely. There's always people upset. And so at the time, the game was controlled by quick guards, and they worked the ball around until they could get a good shot, which was either a layup attempt or a two-handed set shot from more than 25 feet.
16,000 fans watch the boys from the Pacific Coast as they try to stem the onslaught of City College Beavers. But it's all over when Silverstein shoots off the hardwood to cage the ball and the ball game for CCNY 38-36. But the evening's court sport is a long way from the locker rooms. In the second game, a team of Northwestern Wildcats is matched against St. John's University of Brooklyn. The lads from Illinois are off to a springboard start.
Basketball's big men were looked down upon at this time. Similarly, they have been in recent times. We could talk about that later.
Yeah.
They were seen as uncoordinated freaks.
Yeah. <he's...
laughs> So big men were there to get the rebound and get out of the way. And for those of you wondering, George Mikan was a big man, and we'll talk more about this.
He's a big boy.
He was 6'10". So he's a big boy at this era. And so George Mikan initially tried out for Joliet Catholic High School, right here in Joliet, which still exists to this day. His tryout kind of lent some credence to this perception. Now, he was already very self-conscious about his height, and he wore which are now familiar thick horn-rimmed glasses. He played with those his entire career, right?
Yeah.
So, but he decided he didn't want to wear them during tryouts. So this gangly kid who had never played basketball anywhere but his yard tried to squint his way through the basketball tryout. And in the team huddle, the coach asked him why he was squinting, and Mikan just mumbled something about the bright lights. The coach is like, well, no one else seems to have a problem with the lights. But he wasn't wearing his glasses, but he wouldn't admit it. And believe it or not, even with two cuts left to get the team to 12 players, the coach asked Mikan for his uniform. And he said, you just can't play basketball with glasses on.
As a guy who wears glasses all the time, every day, I don't even know that I have a pair of contacts that are available right now to me. I can tell you that to wear a pair of glasses, and I guess a pair of croquis is what you would call them, like the little basket.
Yeah.
To wear those during a basketball game is a nightmare. It's awful. It's a sweaty, disgusting mess. Yes. So that's like the first thing I noticed when I looked at it. Like, I can't imagine what this must have been like. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So just like Michael Jordan didn't make his varsity team when he was in high school initially, right? He got cut. Mm-hmm. George Mikan was cut from his team. So Mikan left Joliet Catholic and he decided to try out and go play, for Quigley Preparatory Seminary, which was on Chicago's north side. Now, he did wear his glasses at this point because he realized I can't see.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Now, this is a 2-hour ride from his home in Joliet. And then he eventually went and to DePaul University in Chicago. Yep. He enrolled with the intent to become a lawyer, but he played basketball there. And he played well enough in a scrimmage against the varsity that someone suggested he should go to a good basketball school because DePaul was not a good basketball school.
Wow. What a slit drive by for DePaul out of nowhere. I love it.
I know. So a tryout was actually set up with Notre Dame and its head coach. And more importantly, assistant coach Ray Meyer. Mm-hmm. Again, George Mikan, who didn't know he had broken his right foot a few days before, did not impress. And he remained at DePaul. So he goes to one tryout without glasses. The next one in college, he broke his foot.
And I just want to make a point here, and not to spoil too much of the story. One of the things that ends up ending Mikan's career, the same way that we look at guys like Greg Oden or Yao Ming, is guys who are this big do tend to have issues with their feet in particular. And those injuries add up over time. So it's not stunning that guys who are this big and this athletic do tend to have shortened careers historically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Gives Brooks the pick.
Uh-oh. Oh, Greg went down and, oh, his knee is... Holy cow, Portland doesn't need this. As the Rose Garden is like a library right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, Meyer saw Mikan's potential, but he knew he didn't have much coordination and he needed coaching. So Meyer sent out to change both his coordination and his coaching. But first, he made Mikan learn how to dance. Okay. Now, we've heard stories of this in the past, but this is pretty interesting. So to tap into Mikan's potential, Meyer took to turning Mikan from a human pinball who banged and stumbled his way through the court in an unstoppable force by using what we today would call cross training.
Awesome.
And Meyer hired a co-ed, which I guess is just a term for a female.
A lady, yeah.
A lady, a college age lady. To teach Mikan to dance to improve his footwork. He had Mikan hit the speed bag and jump rope with the boxing team. He made Mikan chase a 5'5" guard around the gym to improve his speed. And Mikan wouldn't jump when he put up hook shots. So Meyer had Mikan jump over a bench while shooting. Okay. So he really was trying to transform him entirely.
And you know what's interesting too is if you take Mikan out of this section that you're looking at right here.
Yeah.
It is sort of a precursor to the idea of how you would train a modern big man. I know, you know, not to bring the wrestling thing back into it, but when I was growing up, the big story was if you wanted to be a professional wrestler, what you needed to do was take ballet because you needed to understand the movement and how to control your body. And that made you that much better at your job.
Yeah. Being able to control your body in space, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So the most important drill was one that Meyer devised to help Mikan develop ambidexterity, so he could use two hands. And it's a drill that coaches still use to this day called the Mikan drill.
Named after George Mikan, he played for the Minneapolis Lakers. He is the first big man, and this drill was used for his dexterity around the basket. So what we're going to do is work our layup footwork. Ian on the left side, go ahead, is going to step with his right, left knee up. He's going to step through and now make a righty layup. He's going to step through and make a lefty layup. Some of the teaching points, you want him to turn his shoulder. He's catching the ball and not bringing any lower than where he catches it.
So they spent 6 days a week one summer working out as Mikan perfected the drill. Now, the drill is laying the ball up with his left hand on the left side of the hoop, catching the ball and keeping it above his head because no one could reach it there as it came through and laying the ball up with his right hand until his legs turned to jelly. So he just goes back and forth, back and forth. So Mikan's newfound ability to close to the hoop represented a dramatic shift on both ends of the floor. No one had played near the rim, let alone above it at this point in the end in any basketball.
Right. Yeah.
He wasn't in the NBA yet. He's only in college.
Right.
And goaltending hadn't even been defined yet as Mikan, playing center in Meyer's zone defense, would stand in front of an opponent's hoop and just knock shots away. And coaches and fans had a fit. No one had thought of goaltending because players such as Mikan, they just didn't exist.
Because I used to goaltend, go up and stop the ball from going in the hoop. I could jump high enough to stop it, whether it be offense or defense. And guys like Adolph Rupp, Joe Lovchik again, and a whole bunch of them didn't like that rule. And they didn't have anyone around that could do that, so they legislated that you cannot hit the ball or touch the ball on its downward descent.
No, I just got to say, when I was a little kid, this is how I thought basketball was played. I was like, well, you just get the big guy, and he stands out front, and he stops everybody like this. I didn't understand that there was three-second defensive violations or anything like that. Yeah.
No, I know. And this is how you would play against little kids. You just stand at the basket and swat it away.
What I do to my nieces and nephews and my kids in school. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom. So in 1944, the NCAA did finally ban goaltending.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it wasn't
took a while.
It did. It didn't exist. And on offense, Mikan and Ray Meyer's summer workouts unleashed a force for the next 3 years unlike the game had ever seen. With Mikan, DePaul went to the NCAA Final Four in 1943 and won the NIT in 1945. And at this point in time, the NIT was the big tournament, just so everybody knows.
Yep.
Right? His 53 points against Rhode Island in a 97-53 victory in the 45 NIT semis is still a DePaul record. And Mikan remains fifth on the Blue Demons all-time scoring list with 1,870 points. Now, Ray Meyer and George Mikan were 81-17 in their time together at DePaul.
Which is crazy because as a guy who, when I was younger, was looking at DePaul as a potential college to go to when I was looking for colleges, I can tell you that their basketball program is very mediocre. It's not bad. It's not bad, but they're certainly not the top level basketball in the area, certainly anymore.
Not at all. And just to point out, if you didn't catch that, he scored 53 points against Rhode Island. Rhode Island as a team scored 53 points.
I did see that. So theoretically, he could have done this by himself.
He could have. It would have been tied, but still. So after his final season at DePaul, Mikan had a choice to go to law school or play professional basketball, which at this point in time, basketball is at the bottom of the sports pecking order, right?
Yes, big time. Big time.
But thanks to his unprecedented college career, Mike had received numerous offers from teams in what was then the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America. But he chose to stay in Chicago, joining many former DePaul teammates with the Chicago American Gears of the National Basketball League.
I'm going to tell you right now, I've already started looking for Chicago American Gears paraphernalia for Christmas for you. So prepare yourself for that. I just wanted to bring that up.
That would be sweet. Now, and at the time, he signed for an unheard of 5-year, $60,000 contract, right?
Bank. So Bank much money.
1940, whatever.
That's a huge deal. Yeah.
45. So he suited up for the Gears just before the 1946 World Professional Basketball Tournament. And scored 100 points in 5 games and helped the Gears to a third place finish in the tournament. This would be the last time a team with a healthy Mikan didn't win a professional title. Okay.
Which is wild, wild stat. It's insane crazy stat. Yeah.
So when Gears owner Maurice White cut Mikan's brother Joe, he also wanted to cut George's salary in half, but George held out. Lawsuits were filed. And Gears stumbled to a 9-10 record. But with Mikan back, the Gears finished 26-18, good for third in their division, and went on to win the 1947 NBL title. Now, using Mikan's star power as his meal ticket, White, after being denied the NBL's commissioner's position that he had sought, had the bright idea of breaking away from the NBL and forming a 24-league team called the Professional Basketball League of America. Now, pro basketball had 3 leagues now. The NBL, the BAA, and the PBLA. And predictably, the PBLA struggled against the 2 established leagues and folded 2 weeks into the season.
I love this era of sports, by the way. It's my favorite.
It is like the Wild West, right?
Just insanity out here, yeah.
It is. And as the PBLA imploded, the NBL's Detroit Gems went bankrupt. In their one season in the NBL, the Gems had been a disaster. So Minnesota businessmen Ben Berger and Morris Chalfin were convinced by sports writer Sid Hartman that a pro basketball team would be good for Minneapolis. Now, Berger bought the rights to the franchise for $15,000, and there was a new team in the NBL, the Minneapolis Lakers. Now, this is a fun fact. If you type in Detroit Gems into a Google search, you'll get the most recent Lakers score. I've done it. You should try it.
I'll take a look at that in just a second. I just want to make a point real quick before we get to it. Even here, even in the precursor of the modern NBA, which we'll get to in just a second, even before they moved to Los Angeles, the Lakers still somehow lucking out like crazy to get a player who just falls into their laps. Classic Lakers behavior. Don't hate me, Lakers fans. I'm sorry.
Exactly. So with many of the PBLA players having defected from the NBL, the league put all PBLA players, including George Mikan, into an NBL draft disbursement pool. And the Lakers, formerly the 4-40 Gems from Detroit, had the number one overall pick. And the Lakers and general manager Max Winter surprised no one by choosing George Mikan.
Champion Lakers. With Mikan and Mick and Paul and Blue and Kunda running the team. The team's terrific to be specific, your basketball supreme. There's something about that Lakers score that makes the fans want.
Exactly as you said, Sam. The Lakers get what they want.
Always. I don't understand how it happened. Why not the Knicks? Because I got some sad stuff about the Knicks in here later, but we'll get there in just a minute. Yeah.
So Mikan didn't want to uproot his family from Chicago. His wife, her relatives, his relatives were in the area or close by. And Minneapolis was a haul. And as cold as Chicago can get in the winter, cold is different in Minnesota. In Chicago, he could also finish his law degree and start a practice. So he didn't really want to do this, but he flew to Minneapolis to listen to Winter and Hartman's pitch to play for the Lakers. Now, getting Mike into the Twin Cities didn't seem to be a problem, but keeping him there was. After hours of talk, no deal had been struck, and Mikan and his lawyer scheduled a flight back to Chicago. Mikan asked Hartman to drive him to the airport. Hartman said yes, but he and Winter had no intention of getting Mikan to his plane on time. Now, Lakers general manager Max Winter and I, Hartman wrote in his obituary for Mikan in the Star Tribune in 2005, negotiated with Mikan, who wanted $12,000 a year, which was a lot of money in those days. The story has been told before how Mikan broke off negotiations with us, and I drove him to the airport to catch the day's last flight to Chicago. Winter suggested in Hebrew that I make sure he missed his plane home. Well, I went north instead of south, and he missed the flight. Mikan had to stay here overnight, and the next day we signed him to a 3-year deal for $12,000 per year. It was the same contract given to our other star player at the time, Jim Pollard.
Fun fact, this is the same technique the Buffalo Bills used to sign Mario Williams in 2000. They just kept him in Buffalo for like 4 days until he wore down and signed.
There you go.
But again, this ties into the Wild West thing. This was how you would have had to do it. You had to do whatever it took back then to make this happen.
You're absolutely right. So thanks to this, the Lakers had a centerpiece to a future dynasty. Now, by teaming Mikan with Jim Pollard, their other star player, who was a speedy athletic small forward, the Lakers steamed toward a 43-17 record and first place in the NBL's West Division. Now, Mikan, who averaged one third, which was 21.3 points of the Lakers' 64.1 points per game, was even better in the playoffs, scoring 244 points in 10 games as the Lakers rolled to the 47-48 NBL title, Mikan's second title in as many professional seasons. So again, the game was different. They averaged 64 points per game at this point in a professional basketball game.
Well, there's some really interesting efficiency numbers with that I want to get to later. But yeah, it's really important that you understand that the game is significantly slower, significantly less scoring. Exactly.
And he sinks one.
Wizard White, Colorado's All-American, gets free and scores a looping bank shot. But Temple sharpshoots to victory by a 60-36 score for the national title.
because 21.3 doesn't seem like a lot today in today's NBA, but when it's a third of your team's points, it's a lot.
Yeah.
So the heavily East Coast based BAA, being in direct competition with the mostly Midwestern NBL at the time, was desperate for a player of Mikan's impact on the floor, but more importantly, with the star power to put people in the seats. So it did what most rival leagues had done throughout the early histories of the respective professional sports. It raided the NBL of its best teams. Now, before the 1948-49 season, the BAA took the Lakers, their rivals, the Rochester Royals, now the Sacramento Kings, and the Fort Wayne, now Detroit Pistons, with the biggest star, Mikan, of course, being the main reason for the pilfering. In turn, the champion Lakers had traded the small towns of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Oshkosh, Anderson, Indiana, for the big arenas in Boston, Philadelphia, and New York City. So with Mikan's presence in the BAA, it represented a paradigm shift in the sport's offense. In the two seasons before Mikan and the Lakers joined the BAA for the 48-49 season, the league's average field goal percentage was an astonishingly low 0.279, so 27.9% in 46 and 47, and a not much better 28.4% in 47-48.
I just want to jump in there because this ties into the efficiency thing. I'm sure that by the time we get to the end, we will have the conversation of how a guy like George Mikan would fare in the NBA today. And one of the things that people will point to about how he wouldn't work is his efficiency and how poor the shooting percentage is. But again, the league itself in 1948-1949 is averaging 32.7% as a league. At 41.6% from the field, he is the second highest efficiency in the whole league. Again, just trying to reframe your context, folks, for what this actually looks like. This is an outrageously high shooting percentage in 48.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Mike, and he scorched the league to the tune of 1,698 points for an astronomical 28.3 points per game on 41.6% shooting, as you just said. Mm-hmm. And Mikan's total points and his average were easily BAA records. He also shot more free throws, made more free throws, and contributed 20.9 win shares. Now, this was the first of three consecutive 20-plus win share seasons for Mikan. Only Wilt Chamberlain with six had more, and only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Michael Jordan had as many with three seasons apiece. Okay. Mm-hmm. LeBron James and Oscar Robertson are the only other players with a 20-plus win share season in the NBA history.
It's quite a list you want to be on there.
Yeah, I'll say.
So we might as well jump in here since we're getting to the 1950s, and I'm just going to teach y'all folks a very quick history lesson about the NBA. So bear with me for just a moment, just again for some context. The NBA, as we consider it today, the National Basketball Association, was formed in 1949 with the merger of the two rival organizations, the NBL, which was founded in 37, and the BAA, the Basketball Association of America, from 1946. 1950 was the first NBA championship being held under this banner. Although there are records of three other champions between the years of 47 and 49, it is still played under the Basketball Association of America banner. This was the decade that laid the platform for what is today known as the NBA Finals. The first half of the 50s was essentially dominated by George Mikan's Lakers, who won the title four out of the first 5 years of the decade, right? They won the first in 1950 after losing in the Western Division Finals. The Rochester Royals in 51 were considered, that win was considered the biggest upset in basketball history at the time. After this defeat, the Lakers were able to bounce back by winning three consecutive titles between 1952 and 1954.
In his day, he was by far and away the number one player in the NBA.
They called him the gentle giant. But he was not gentle on the floor. I mean, he played hard and he played aggressive and he gave 100% every second he was out there.
George Mikan forces his way through the center, spins and shoots, and is fouled by Paul Tima.
The footage I remember of him was a tall, nice-looking man in glasses, winning the championship, kissing all his teammates.
Second half of the decade proved to be much more competitive, with the Celtics winning it twice, a rogue championship for my beloved Syracuse Nationals, the Philadelphia Warriors, the St. Louis Hawks were all champions in the 50s. I just want to make a point here. The NBA today only acknowledges four championships for George Mikan. 1950, right. 1952, 53, and 54. If you count the championships he won before this, he has 7 in 8 years, which makes him maybe the most dominant player in NBA history outside of Bill Russell, maybe?
Right.
Somewhere along those lines. I just want to make this quick point. The team that was unluckiest during this decade was, of course, my beloved New York Knicks, who reached the final for 3 consecutive years between 51 and 53 before agonizingly losing all 3, 2 of them going to Game 7. Matter of fact, in 1951, they even came back from a 3-0 deficit against the Rochester Royals, a very upstate battle here. They tied it going into the last 2 minutes of Game 7 and then lost 79-75. Mm. The Knicks could have come back from down 3-0. They could have broken that record years ago.
We had De Blasio, we had Cuomo. It was rough shit, but we have the Knicks. The New York Knicks run New York City.
Bing bong.
Tell me a little something, KD. Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks? Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks?
Let's go, Knicks.
George Mikan was easily the most successful player of this decade, winning, like you said, 4 NBA titles. Retiring in 1954, but he would come back in 1956, took over the reins as the head coach of the Lakers in 1957. And it was during that decade, under him as the head coach, we saw some of the greatest players to ever grace the court. Bill Russell, Elgin Baylor, guys like that in the same era. So, Randall, there you go. Sorry about that long history in brief, folks. I thought a little context might help out.
Yeah, no, that I appreciate that, Sam. That helps a lot. So the first season, as we've kind of talked about, the Lakers would sweep their way through the Chicago Stags and Rochester's Royals en route to defeating Red Auerbach's Washington Capitals 4-2 in the finals for the Lakers' first BAA title. Mikan's third pro title in as many seasons. Mikan played with a broken right wrist in the last 2 games. No worries. Scored 51 points in those 2 contests. Now, by this time, Mikan's dominance as a player on the floor and status off of it was unquestioned. He was pro basketball's first superstar at the time when pro basketball desperately needed a larger-than-life figure. Yep. Mikan more than provided it in the media capital of the United States, New York City. Mikan was no stranger to sophisticated New York basketball fans, having played in and dominated the NIT at Madison Square Garden. And while he and the Lakers were scheduled to play the Knicks in December 1949, the game was billed as George Mikan versus the Knicks.
Mikan was really the substance of the league. I remember Madison Square Garden one night had George Mikan versus Knicks, not Knicks versus the Lakers.
So we all got dressed and ready to go on the floor. George got up and walked out the door. We all sat there. And he said, where are you guys doing? We says, well, George, your name's up there. You go play him. So we joked around a lot.
And Mikan gave the folks a show with 38 points. But the Knicks won that game 94-84.
Bing bong, I believe I'm supposed to say. Go ahead.
The loss to the Knicks dropped the Lakers to 14-7 at the time as they struggled to incorporate rookie Vern Mikkelsen into the offense. Both Mikan and the 6'7" Mikkelsen were centers, and Lakers coach John Kundla decided to play a double pivot with 2 centers near the hoop. One problem, the lane being 6 feet wide at the time was clogged with both big men, and the Lakers stumbled to a 16-10 start. So something had to give, and it wasn't going to be George Mikan. Kundla moved Mikkelsen out of the post and had him face the basket. Mikkelsen said it took him 2 years to learn the new position, but essentially he became basketball's first power forward. Now, the Lakers, led by Mikan's 27.4 points per game, went 35-7 the rest of the way, tying the Rochester Royals for the Central Division crown. The Lakers then proceeded to go 11-2 in the postseason, defeating the Syracuse Nationals 4-2 to win the first championship under the National Basketball Association banner in 1950. And in an era which most teams averaged between 80 and 84 points per game, Mikan averaged an astronomical 31.3 points per game to earn his 4th pro title in as many seasons. That same year. Yeah.
I just want to make a point that I did some math on that. That averages out to above 40 points a game in 2023. So he'd be averaging 40 plus with that number in modern times. Yeah. Insane.
It is insane. That same year, Mikan was named the best basketball player for the first half of the 20th century. Now, Mikan may have had his best season in 50-51, dominating the NBA in both ends of the floor. He led the league in points, points per game, 28.3, field goals made, and free throws made. Yet the Lakers wouldn't win the title in 1951 as a broken ankle hobbled Mikan in the postseason. He tried to play on it, but without Mikan at full health, the Lakers fell to the rival Royals in the Western Division Finals.
I just want to make a point in case anyone's curious why we haven't brought up rebounding. Rebounding wasn't even really a stat that was kept until about halfway through Mikan's career, in case you were curious.
Yeah, because that would have been off the charts as well.
Insane. Would have been nuts. Yeah,
exactly. Throughout the years, teams tried other ways to stop Mike and the Lakers, namely stalling after getting a lead. The most infamous example was when Mikan scored 15 of the Lakers' 18 points in a 19-18 loss against Fort Wayne on November 22nd, 1950.
And then in 1950-51, the Fort Wayne Pistons played the Lakers, and they played stall ball because they didn't want Mikan to get the ball and hurt them. The final score of that game was 19-18. Can you imagine that? And then 3 years later, the NBA instituted the 24-second clock, mainly because of George Mikan.
So many contributions to the game while he was alive. And even
I'm so glad you brought this up. This was my favorite part of the research. I'm so glad that we talked about this. I'm so happy to find this out. Outrageous sportsmanship.
Ridiculous. Yeah. So while Mikan and his game are not directly responsible for the one most significant rule change in the history of sports, the 24-second clock, it's often pointed to as one of the reasons for it.
Yeah.
And even though the Lakers lost to the Royals, the NBA had seen enough of Mikan's low post dominance. Although everyone tried to find a center to counter him, no team could find a match for Mikan. So before the 51-52 season, the NBA tried to slow Mikan as it widened the lane from 6 feet to 12. It didn't help. After not making the finals in 51, the Lakers would go on to win the next three NBA titles, giving the franchise that was bought in bankruptcy for $15,000, five BAA NBA titles in 6 seasons, and Mikan's 7 pro titles in 8 seasons. And Mikan retired after the 53-54 season, months before the NBA instituted the 24-second clock. He would then move to the Lakers front office before coming out of retirement, as you said, in 55-56. But at that point, he was too slow for a fast-paced game. He played in a career-low 37 games that season and averaged a career-low 10.5 points per game. He retired after the Lakers lost to the St. Louis Hawks in the postseason. Now, when he calls the quits, Mikan held the NBA record for most points per game, field goals, free throws, and most win shares. Mikan is still 66th overall in that advanced stat, ahead of other Hall of Famers such as Julius Erving, Elgin Baylor, and Allen Iverson. Now, we just saw the scoring title get handed from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar,
yes,
the famous Laker, to LeBron James, who's not necessarily known as a Laker, but he's a Laker right now, right?
I would argue that a lot of Laker fans claim him now as a Laker, especially since they won that title. I think they do. That seems to be the case from what I've talked to with Lakers fans.
So, yeah. So, but of course, the first scoring champ was, of course, a Laker.
Always. It always is. It has to be.
Yeah.
Lakers or Celtics.
Exactly. But if that's not impressive enough, he came up big when his team needed him most. His teams were 18-2 in postseason series.
Yeah. I think the point I want to get, he retired at the age of 31, which would make him 6 years younger than me currently. He decided that's enough. I'm done here. 31.
Well, his body just took a beating. I mean, you heard of all the injuries, right? He just couldn't continue. Yeah. And Mikan was a game changer after his playing days as well. After a stint as a Lakers head coach in 57-58, he only went 9-30. Mikan was elected to the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame's first class in 1959. And 8 years later, Mikan had his hand in basketball history again, this time as commissioner of the American Basketball Association in 1967, the ABA, instituting the now iconic red, white, and blue basketball. And more importantly, the three-point line. The NBA would adopt the three-point line before the 79-80 season, but the ABA already had it. But unfortunately, he didn't have an NBA pension, and he struggled with diabetes, and Mikan ended up dying in 2005. But another great Lakers center, Shaquille O'Neal, paid for Mikan's funeral.
And I'll put in right here, there's a really interesting and beautiful tribute that Shaq did on the Lakers YouTube that I'll put here. It's about 40 seconds of him talking about Mikan and what he meant to his career. It's great. So,
you know, be mentioned with the great big men. But when I met Mr. Mikan was treating me like I was the legend. No, seriously. Where he came and he'd, you know, nice older fellow. And he's like, Shaq, how you doing, sir? Can I have your autograph? And I'm like, Mr. Mikan, do you want my autograph? I should be asking you for your autograph. He's like, no, man, you're the greatest big man I've ever seen. And I actually like brought like a little, you know, tear to mind.
And here's a couple of quotes. He literally carried the league, said Bob Cousy. He gave us recognition and acceptance when we were at the bottom of the totem pole in professional sports. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said he showed us how to do it. I certainly would not have the hook shot that went in if it wasn't for the fundamentals I learned from George Mikan's game. Yeah, I didn't mention that, but Mikan he did have a hook shot from both sides. Yes. It was the first hook shot. So
the ambidextrous.
Yeah, they all learned it from him. Yeah. They made him ambidextrous. So he was revered by a lot of the big men that came after him because they saw what he did and what they could do because he showed them how to do it. And George Mikan today, he is number 35 on the NBA list, NBA at 75 list, which kind of lists the 75 most important or best players in the NBA history.
I thought that was low when you sent this to me. I was like, wow, 35 feels kind of low for the importance. And then I happened to look up a Bleacher Report list of the greatest Lakers of all time, and they only have him at 9. So he's not even the 10th. He's barely in the top 10 for Lakers, apparently. No, I mean, it just depends on whether you value like history and legacy versus like sheer dominance. And I guess this is the part where I have to ask you, Randall.
Yeah.
What do you believe a guy like this would be able to do in the modern NBA? Do you believe that athletes are too fast and too big today, or do you think his sheer talent would have been able to carry through?
Oh, I definitely think they're probably bigger, faster, stronger today than.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you're looking at it. If he were born in this era, you know, he obviously had athletic ability and maybe, I don't know, you know, I mean, it's so hard to compare a sports era from 80 years ago, 70 years ago.
And before we run out of time here, I want two things I just wanted to share with you that I happened to see before we close up. Number one, do yourself a favor, folks. Go on YouTube and look up the George Mikan Sports Center commercial. Yes, it exists with him and Bob Lay and Rich Eisen. It's hilarious. It's worth the minute and a half.
It's nice having the athletes hang out at Sports Center. It's a little interesting, though, when some of the old-timers stop by to share opinions.
Take a look at these highlights. All you see are the dunk shots. Yeah, whatever happened to the two-handed set shot? A real highlight, in my estimation, is a nice chest pass or a bounce pass. What's with those baggy shorts? You need a pair of suspenders to hold them up. When we played, we just had a slab of rubber on a canvas top, and that was it. Come on, chest pass. Come on, Bob, think quick.
George. And, you know, we talked about the sort of up and down views of centers in the NBA right now.
Yeah.
Jokic, Embiid, Davis, Cat, Bam Adebayo, Rudy Gobert, DeAndre Ayton, Mitchell Robinson and the Knicks. I'm going to throw it in because I'm a homer. Is the center back?
I think it is. I really do. It's but they're more so much more versatile now because, you know, all of these centers that you mentioned have the ability to pass the ball as well.
Yes.
Which is essential. Right. Yeah, no, I think that the big man is back, but they're so talented right now and they can all shoot. And, you know, that's a huge difference from all of our eras. But so that's the story of George Mikan, who is the first Laker great.
And Randall, I want to thank you so much. I learned a ton about George Mikan and a little bit about Joliet, Illinois as well. Thought it was fascinating, and I have been thinking a lot since we recorded this episode. I would love to know. I would love to be able to stack these guys up against each other in a real scenario. It's like I just want to see him play against somebody, and just somebody from the modern era. Like, how would it work? Could he make it happen? And as I'm watching a lot of the videos, I think the one problem that George Mikan has compared to a lot of these guys at the lists I'm looking at for like top 10 centers.
Sure.
It's the actual physical girth, not the height, but a lot of these dudes are way more muscular than a dude like Mikan was. Even when I posted that photo on Instagram, almost kind of like scrawny in the legs. They don't, again, it's 1948. It's a different type of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They, the without a doubt, training was way different back then. Nutrition was different. Their off seasons were much different. I mean, it's, a totally different era.
Yeah, George Mikan probably worked at a hardware store in his free time off.
Well, he wanted to be an attorney, so that's what he was working towards.
The other flip side of this is something we always talk about, like in history. Like if you could go back in time with like modern day stuff, could you like take over the whole United States? Like if you went back today with like a modern gun and a modern ATV and a bunch of people, could you just take over all the 13 counties? You probably could. Who's going to stop you? Probably.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And I guess the sports equivalent is like if you had dropped Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Shaq or Olajuwon in one of these games in the 1940s, would it be like a superhero?
You know, I think that's what Wilt Chamberlain was, right? I mean, because after Mikan, a few years later, came, you know, Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain. And I'm sure Wilt Chamberlain was probably viewed as something like a superhero. He scored 100 points in a game.
So they have Wilt on this Hoops Hype center list that I'm looking at as the third greatest center of all time behind Bill Russell at two and Kareem. Here's just a real quick.
Really?
Two NBA titles, one finals MVP, four MVPs, seven all-NBA first-team selections, 13 All-Stars, two defensive first-team selections, number one rebounder in NBA history, and seventh in scoring all time in NBA history. He's also 81st in assists as a center in NBA history, which is kind of wild.
Yeah. No, I would have never guessed that.
Yeah. And this is the thing. Like, again, I'm a little too young to have watched Wilt and Kareem and any of those dudes at their height.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like I missed out on the opportunity to watch those dudes when they were really killing it.
Yeah. No, I absolutely. I mean, I remember watching Kareem, but not. I don't know when the other two, Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain, retired. I was.
Well, Bill Russell's an interesting one because he feels like he's from a different generation, but he's after Mikan, obviously, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there are color pictures of Bill Russell. There's not as many color photos of Mikan.
No.
And I got one for you that sort of showed up and was sort of listed as maybe the most underappreciated of all these guys was Moses Malone, who I feel like doesn't get talked about at all whenever anyone talks about centers.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I remember the name more than anything.
Yeah.
Right. And it comes up, but I don't remember his play at all. So I can't, unfortunately, I can't speak to it from that perspective. But yeah, you're right. I think he is probably underrated.
Do you want to make a wild NBA prediction for the remainder of these playoffs before we move on?
Yeah. I mean, I've been wrong on every single prediction so far.
So we don't make predictions.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's what I learned since last time I talked about the NBA. Miami wants it more than the Knicks do. And whether or not the Knicks can get... They just do. I've watched enough of these games. They're just out-hustling them. They're out-rebounding them. It just is what it is. Like, they're a grittier team. They're probably better coached. Spo's been a great coach for 20 years.
Yeah,
and I love Tibbs, but, it is what it is. I'm not saying they can't take it to seven, but I don't feel good about it. I really... thought the Lakers were going to win last night.
Did you?
Yeah.
In San Francisco?
I felt like the
Warriors are the champs. I mean, they're not going to go down without a fight.
Well, you know what it was? I think when the Warriors came out to that big lead and then by the end of the first, it was back to like 3 points.
Yeah, it was close.
They kind of gave them their best punch and the Lakers just sort of shrugged it off. So I assume that if they can survive this, they're going to have a streak and get back in it. I was kind of surprised they didn't pull it out last night. I got to be honest.
Oh,
just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, no, I fully expected the Warriors to win that game. It's this tomorrow. I think they play, right?
Yeah.
In LA. That's the game that's going to, determine everything.
Well, all these games will be over by the time people hear this. So they'll know if we were right or wrong for sure. I will say, because of this episode, though, I was thinking that now I do kind of want the finals to just be Jokic versus Embiid. Like, I kind of think that that's really what I want to see, is let me see the two best centers, the two most recent MVPs, the two guys battling for it. Let's see it for the title. Let's see who's got the juice.
Yeah, no, I think that would be amazing. I don't know that the NBA is rooting for that. Mm-mm. I'm sure they would much rather have LA or the Warriors in the NBA finals. But yeah, I am all for it, because I think those are probably the two best teams still left, don't you think?
Oh, 1,000%. And I look at the team, like Miami and New York, I feel like neither of them should be in this round. So they're both, they're like, somehow both teams are playing with house money. And I don't know what happened with Boston. Is it Mazzulla? Is he not, maybe he's not a good coach? I don't know.
I've heard that that could be the case, that he's just inexperienced. Right. But yeah, I don't know what happened to them either. And Tatum, you know, his numbers are always good at the end of the game, but sometimes he's gone for a half.
I think I heard Kevin O'Connor say this on the Mismatch, but essentially, like, with a guy like Tatum and a guy like Jaylen Brown, you probably got to pay them like their top five players in the NBA. Mm-hmm. And they're probably top 15 guys, but they're probably not top five guys. Maybe Tatum, depends how much you like Tatum, but
yeah,
I would probably really say, be sure.
I think Tatum's probably top 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're right. Brown is probably top 15 ish.
I like Jaylen Brown. If the Knicks could find a way to make that happen, I would like that very much to happen, but I don't know if that's the case. Before we close out here with anything, I just wanted to, unless you have anything else, I wanted to talk about soccer with you for just one second.
Yeah. Okay.
Because last week, when we did the slip episode, I had mentioned a documentary that I had watched back in 2006 when it came out, called Once in a Lifetime, The Extraordinary Tale of the New York Cosmos. And after we talked about it, I went looking for it and I could not find it on any streaming platform. I did find it on YouTube. It's broken up into like 10 parts. If you type in, you know, Once in a Lifetime, Extraordinary Tale of the New Cosmos.
Yeah.
Man, it was better than I thought it was. It was way better than I gave it. And I liked it. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot how fascinating this. And it's one of those documentaries that I watched. And I was like, man, I'd love to do an episode of the show about this. But why? Because there's already this amazing documentary that I'm currently watching. Right. So that's what I was thinking about. And it got me sort of thinking, you know, just in general, like, I think soccer's big problem is really just packaging in the United States. You still haven't figured out how to market it correctly to Americans. Because I thought this video, I was like, oh, this is amazing. They figured it out in 77, 78, how to get Americans into soccer, and we just can't do it again. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
We figured it out for like 3 years.
Right, right. I think you're right. It also, I mean, don't you think it has to do with the fact that we don't, and you're talking about Major League Soccer, I'm assuming, right? The MLS?
Yeah, Major League Soccer, yeah.
So specifically here? So isn't it just we as Americans want to have the best players playing in our leagues, and the MLS doesn't get those players, right? Unless they're on their downside of their career or whatever.
We don't like sports where we are scrappy underdogs. We have a scrappy underdog mentality, or we think we do. Like, oh, we beat the Russians in hockey. But exactly. We're also really good at hockey. So, like, we don't like a sport where a smaller country can embarrass us. And that's one of the things that happens in soccer all the time, is I watch the U.S. get beat by like San Marino and Panama and Honduras.
Yeah.
These countries that have less population than like one state, and up sudden how they're kicking our ass. And I'm like, what is wrong with us? I don't understand why we can't pull it together. And I've said it before, because the very best soccer player in the world was probably Kobe Bryant, and he played for the Lakers. You know what I'm saying? Like those guys would be the soccer players of America.
Sure.
We already pay too much to play football or basketball or baseball.
Right, right, right. That to me is, I think, the why it isn't packaged better. It's just, you know, we just expect our leagues in America to have the best talent in the world. I mean, you know, take a look at Major League Baseball. We're taking from everywhere, right? You know, well, there aren't really a lot of NFL players that are from not from the United States because they don't play that sport anywhere else. But, you know, basketball, they all eventually they're going to come to the NBA. I mean, that's the league.
Well, we'll get to it in maybe three or four episodes when we talk about Drazen Petrovic. But, you know, you look at the top four of the five guys in the MVP race this year. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Embiid, absolutely. Doncic, all these dudes are European dudes, and they're trying to grow the sport, man. They want more eyes. There's only so – I think all the people who want to watch the NBA in America are either already watching it or just not interested, right? Like, if you're interested in basketball, you're watching it. How do you make that audience bigger if you've saturated the entire market in the United States in terms of people who are invested? Overseas, Europe, get people in here, grow that market, expand it out. And that's what you're going to see. Like, you're going to see the college system keep going, and you're going to see all these European dudes coming in. And that's what the game's going to look like going forward. And I think we're not too far away from that being pretty common.
Well, and you're right. I mean, look at what the NFL is doing. They're going to play a bunch of European games this year, right? I think they're doing a few in London, and then they're going to Germany. So they're trying to grow their reach, and, you know, they're number one, right, in the U.S. as a sport. So everybody's looking overseas.
It's so interesting, too, because I hate to take it back to wrestling. I just watched a wrestling pay-per-view that took place last weekend, and it was in Puerto Rico. It'd be the first time that the WWE had come to Puerto Rico in like 20 years.
Right. Okay.
And that crowd was insane. They were so, no matter what happened, anything, it didn't matter. They were going nuts and the show was awesome. And then like the next week they go back to like, you know, whatever, Gainesville, and people were just like, man, ho-hum. When you don't get to experience these things regularly, you know, like I think about when the NFL goes to England, they fill those Wembley stadiums to people to watch the Jaguars versus the Jets just because they've never seen football. I'm curious of this thing.
Right. Right. No, absolutely.
Right. The other one I just wanted to mention real quick, since I was on the documentary thing before I closed, you got into F1 because of the TV show. Is this true? We talked about this a little bit.
No, I did not get into, I got into it before the TV show.
Okay.
And I don't watch the TV show. I watched like two episodes of the TV show and I'm like, nah, not for me. You know, well, because, you know, have you seen this show?
No, I have not.
Okay. So, you know, it's one of those shows where it's sort of like Hard Knocks, right? Where the stuff has already happened. So you kind of, but Hard Knocks, you don't watch training camp, right? But with F1, I saw those races, and then you see like the behind the scenes after the fact. And I'm like, you know, it wasn't that interesting to me. But I know that it's skyrocketed the popularity of F1 in the U.S. specifically.
Big time.
Which is great because I find it to be I came into it just like I came into the Premier League. It's on usually really early on Sunday morning where I can sit down and watch the race without anyone bothering me. And that's, you know, so I would flip from, you know, usually the Premier League and F1 right on the weekend. So that's how I got into it. And then it's great. During they race, you know, primarily through the spring, summer, and then early fall. But once the NFL starts up, you watch a race, and then you got the NFL, and, you know, it makes for a nice day.
Well, I just wanted to bring up, in my documentary deep dive this week, after watching the documentary on the New York Cosmos, I went back, and also on YouTube, I found a documentary from 2010 called Senna, S-E-N-N-A. And this also, I was like, man, what a phenomenal documentary. Yeah. I forgot how good this was. Man, what that a story. And I was thinking, and after watching it, I kind of understood why this F1 show was popular and brought people in. Because when you learn about the characters, and you're not just looking at the cars.
Right.
All of a sudden, the investment in it is like I didn't know who Alan Proust was, and then all of a sudden, 15 minutes in, I'm like, this guy sucks. I don't like this guy. I got issues with you, Alan Proust. Yeah, yeah. But
absolutely.
I forgot how good it was, really. It was the key when I was digging it up.
Yeah, no, that is a great documentary. I enjoyed that one a lot. But you're right. It's all about the personalities. I mean, that's what creates these stories. That's what we talk about every day, right? Or, you know, once a week when we do our episodes. But, you know, that's what makes these stories fun. And you know, I don't know that modern day F1 has all the personalities that they did back then.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. Maybe they do. And maybe that show is highlighting that more than I give it credit.
Yeah. All right, Randall, this was good stuff this week. We will be back next week. I think Arthur Ashe next week. I haven't totally decided. Probably Arthur Ashe next week. I think we'll do.
That'd be a great one to do.
We're starting to think of, we're getting into second half of the season now. We got to start thinking about season finales and season two and all that good stuff coming up.
Yeah.
So hope you folks are enjoying Instagram, Twitter. I'll do Facebook after I get out of school. I get maybe a couple more days of finishing up school before I can worry about Facebook. Instagram, Twitter, reach out to us on the platforms. I'll be posting this week. Randall, always a pleasure. I will talk to you soon, brother.